Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The Climate Prediction Center is a part of the National Weather Service. And at the National Weather Service, we monitor and provide weather and climate forecasts to serve the public and also for the protection of life and property.
Brad Pugh is a meteorologist with National Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center.
Drought is determined using multiple objective indicators, such as precipitation, soil moisture, and stream flows. But also drought impacts play a role as well in the drought depiction on the map. And it's an iterative process throughout the week. And drought monitor authors do receive feedback from the states and various partners.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
OCP North America is, not surprisingly, the North American subsidiary of OCP, which is a Moroccan-based company that is one of the major global producers and suppliers of phosphate fertilizers, serving farmers across the globe.
Kerry McNamara is CEO of OCP North America, talks about who OCP is and what they do.
OCP is over 100 years old. Morocco, by the grace of God, or dumb geological luck, or some combination of the two, is blessed with the world's largest reserves of phosphate ore, which is the input into phosphate fertilizers.
Rolling into 2022, we knew some of the challenges for the fertilizer industry, but where is it today?
Farmers have really been getting hit with high prices on all their fertilizer inputs, but I think we need to distinguish a couple of things here. The price shock in phosphate fertilizers had a first wave well before the whole Ukraine and Russia situation. And that first wave was caused precisely by the withdrawal of imports from the market in response to the matter we're going to be discussing about the phosphate fertilizer duty case. And then, of course, there's been a further shock that has hit not just phosphate fertilizers, but nitrogen, et cetera. Caused by the broader global fertilizer supply crisis generated by the Ukraine-Russia conflict. Now, we do see prices easing a bit from their ridiculous highs, astronomical highs. Unfortunately, some of that we think is going to be demand destruction at the farmer level, where they just simply, cannot afford and cannot take the risk to buy the level of fertilizers that they'd normally like to apply. So we're going to have to see how that plays out.
Yet there's something kind of interesting happening with the phosphorus fertilizer industry.
We serve markets all around the world, and we've been honored to provide product to farmers in the U.S. and across North America, among other places, for quite a while now. In June 2020, the Mosaic Company, which is the dominant U.S. producer of phosphate fertilizers, put in a complaint saying that imports from Russia and Morocco had harmed them in 2019. Despite the deep flaws in the argument, they won the first round with the International Trade Commission of the Department of Commerce. And so duties were imposed on us, and we had to make the very difficult decision to temporarily withdraw from the market because it's not just that the duties were 20%, but also that because of the way this process goes, the duties could be retroactively increased and increased dramatically down the road. So there's an enormous cloud of uncertainty, but we very much hope that this appeal process we're in will create a situation where we can get back to serving U.S. farmers as we serve currently farmers on both the northern and southern border in both Canada and Mexico.
Right now, the industry is waiting for a ruling. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We're taking what we observe, USDA reports, federal inspected slaughter data, and I quote that at the national level when we do, you know, year-over-year changes, but they do that at the regional level.
Talking about the impact of regional reliance on major beef packers, Dr. Glenn Tonser, Kansas State.
And we also know the presence of large facilities by region, so we can understand how different regions vary in their reliance on larger facilities, and if the pattern of disruption early in the pandemic of running those slaughtering facilities differed by reliance on large facilities. So the data enables us to do that. That's what we do. And in this report, basically we find a two-week period early in 2020 where regions that are more reliant on large beef cattle processing facilities, they had a larger year-over-year decline, but it was contained to 2 weeks. Outside of those 2 weeks, we find no statistical evidence. You know, I don't want to get too geeky here, but we find no strength to the argument that regions that rely on larger operations were more sensitive to pandemics. So all regions had to pull down, kind of regardless of the size mix is the way to think about that. I highlight that because it's a timely point. There's a lot of discussion about adding overall capacity. Some of that's well underway. It's not for me to say we shouldn't do that. That's not the point of my comment. But the real nuance of this assessment is the industry may not have been more sensitive to pandemic because it was relying on large facilities. So the move towards smaller facilities may not help as much as is sort of the default assumption. There may be a place for that in distributing them to get closer to certain operations or to, you know, just geographically having them in different spots of the country for other reasons. But in terms of national sensitivity and robustness of the system, this paper would say relying on large entities may not be as bad as some just presume it is. And the economist may have to add to that. We need to remember why the industry's evolved the way it has. And economies of scale and then the ability to harvest an animal lower per head if you have a larger operation and ultimately being able to transform an animal into edible beef products in a much more efficient way is core to that. We need to understand why, and not just understand, remember why, because it's been documented, the industry evolved the way it did. And studies like this kind of, they need to be kept in mind is the point.
Now, Dr. Stephen Kuntz is an economist with Colorado State University, talks about the concerns with eliminating AMAs.
More bidders, more buyers is always better, but at what cost? And in particular in the Southern Plains, with the closure of the facility at Plainview, became very much a region kind of on razor's edge. The supply of cattle in that area could easily be out of balance with the packing capacity. So that region went very aggressively towards using AMAs so that they knew what was coming. They were able to coordinate. There were some concerns there about price discovery. Folks were active in the market. And I do think the incentive is on both sides of the market. If they're not comfortable with what's being traded to back out, to move back to trade more cash if there's an issue there. But what I've done some research on is that price discovery can very effectively happen with very few trades. There's a lot of other things going on. One of the more important things about price discovery is being able to anticipate what people are thinking is going to happen next in that marketplace. If you go back to prior to COVID, when the shutdowns were taking place, we didn't know what was likely to happen next. And therefore, you need more market participation potentially in that environment. Right now, moving forward, the market is pretty confident that supplies will tighten up, prices will improve dramatically, packer margins will decline. And the price discovery in this situation right now is not tremendously uncertain. So I would be most concerned about what are the costs, and let the underlying players that are doing that determine how they market cattle.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Today, we are at an inflection point that requires us to carefully consider the benefits of an alternative clearing structure and ensure it does not compromise the battle-tested protections and checks of the existing clearing model.
That's Walt Lucan, President, CEO of the Futures Industry Association.
The CFTC is now considering a proposal by FTX that would replace the traditional clearing model that distributes risk using futures commission merchants with a more automated and centralized one. Specifically, the FTX direct clearing proposal would, for the first time, combine margin futures with near real-time margining, 24/7 auto liquidation of under-margined customers, and a self-funded CCP default fund without the benefits of FCMs managing, underwriting, and mutualizing customer risk. It's important to point out that the FTX proposal would permit futures trading in any underlying asset class transacted by any type of customer, including commercial hedgers. This requires us to view this proposal with an eye beyond retail cryptocurrencies. We must also consider the core users of our markets, including farmers, refiners, pension funds, and other Main Street businesses that use futures to hedge price risk in the real economy. When contemplating such transformative change, FIA encourages policymakers to consider the fundamental guiding framework articulated in President Biden's recent executive order on digital assets. Same business, same risks, same rules. FIA believes the CFTC must analyze FTX's proposal against the important customer protections and risk management functions that registered FCMs currently provide the marketplace. As agents for their customers, FCMs hold various regulatory responsibilities, including vetting customers on the appropriateness of these leveraged products, policing clients for money laundering, segregating customer funds, guaranteeing customer trades, holding significant regulatory capital against those trades, contributing to clearinghouse default funds, and agreeing to further assessments should the CCP default fund need replenishment. Today, U.S. registered FCMs contribute more than $15 billion to CCP default funds and hold an additional $175 billion of their own regulatory capital. This layer of financial resources backstops the potential default of customers and protects the markets and the wider financial system from a contagion event. FIA believes there needs to be further analysis of the FTX risk model in extreme but plausible scenarios, especially for large commercial participants in other asset classes beyond retail cryptocurrencies. Given the model relies on continuous liquid markets that are open 24/7, questions remain around the market impact of auto liquidation feature for closeout of large positions in less liquid markets. We must ensure that the model does not trigger a broader fire sale in the central price discovery market that harms hedgers and exacerbates further market disruption. To conclude, FIA supports efforts to further advance real-time risk management and clearing and bring greater competition to the markets. The FTX proposal has advanced a healthy debate in our industry. However, we believe that further analysis and information are needed on the FTX proposal, and we look forward to the deliberative process of the CFTC that will help bring additional clarity and information to this unique clearing model.
This hearing before the House Ag Committee came just a month before the crypto crash. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
That's a common misconception, so I'm glad that you brought it up.
What's that misconception? It's that a shower will pull someone out of drought. Matt Makins is a meteorologist.
People may get a great rainfall for, say, 2 days or 3 days out of a week, and their drought numbers may drop a bit. But when you look at drought, it's not a week. It's not 2 weeks. It's not 4 weeks. You're building and compounding, like you're compounding interest, over a very long span of time. And this drought has been developing and growing over the last several years, especially for the western U.S., especially parts of the Four Corners and the southwest regions. We had this drought for a long time. So sections of Arizona and New Mexico had a very wet June, historically so in parts of New Mexico. But that's great over a short term, but they're not eliminating the drought there. There's just too much water loss that we've suffered. Reservoirs, stream flows, stock ponds, all of that would be included in the drought monitor as we think of it. So all those reservoirs over the west, even some of the lakes throughout the southern plains, central plains, northern plains, really saw quite a drop in that stock water. And that's going to take a very, very long time to recover from. So we need these isolated rainfall events to grow, and we need them very frequently in order to see a really big improvement in the drought. And sadly, as you pointed out, and I have for the last year or so, that's just not going to happen just yet. We have to be patient.
Makin serves clients across North America, including Cattle Facts. But how concerned is he about this drought? Scale of 1 to 10?
I'm very much in the 8-plus range of concern, and that's for a number of reasons. The first and foremost is that we have data that you can look at tree rings, for an example, and sometimes people scoff at that, but you can really look at a tree ring database and go back in time and find periods of substantial droughts that impacted a lot of the country. And in the drought we are in now, for a a multi-decadal drought, you have to go back a long, long time, hundreds and hundreds of years, to find a drought as expansive as this one. So that's one concern there. And that's kind of the data geek in me speaking out. But number two comes into play when, let's take last year for an example, and producers across the western U.S. were scrambling to find enough hay or alfalfa. They started transporting it. I've got a buddy in Wellington, Colorado, northern Colorado. He was selling to producers well west, and the transportation costs, I don't know how they broke even on that, but they were getting a supply. And now let's take that problem and go into this year. And now we've expanded hay losses or alfalfa well into the plains. So if you're a producer across the western U.S., gas prices, you're not going to break even. You're going to lose a lot of money by trying to get to that nearest location for quality hay and take it back home. And I think for me, that's the biggest reason I score an 8-plus on this current drought is, there's not enough relief. We're scrambling multi-states to try to supplement somebody, 2,000 miles away on the other side of the country. And we're all in the same boat. It's not just one region. It's the whole country trying to help each other out and recover. And Mother Nature isn't on our side just yet.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Many of those programs are going to particular packers and dedicated plants. They're going to plants that are specializing in those products or a variety of products.
Dr. Stephen Kuntz is a Colorado State cattle economist, talks about potential unintended consequences with proposed legislation.
And those plants may have very little participation in the cash market, and requiring some sort of minimum trade backs them off of that specialization. And I'm sure that costs. To get at your concerns, so the premiums that are, the real advantages that came from AMA development and use was in cattle management. It was in the underlying feed yards were the ones that had developed those programs, that negotiated them with packers. They're managing those cattle better in terms of knowing when they get marketed, enables those producers to target those premiums. If you're required to go into the cash market and you could for sure chase the premiums through a negotiated grid, but that negotiated grid has the risk that the negotiations fail, that the cattle aren't marketed that week, that are marketed somewhere in the preceding weeks, or if you think the negotiations might fail, you market them earlier. So you wind up losing the production efficiencies as well as the returns on the profit side.
Sean Tiffany with Tiffany Cattle Company in Kansas on how special programs could be affected by a cash mandate.
Programs like non-hormone treated, natural, low-carbon beef, these are not things that you just determine late in the feeding period that this is how you're going to market your cattle. Decisions that influence this type of product being ready at some point in the future happen oftentimes 3 years in advance. You have breeding decisions made at the ranch level prior to gestation, then prior to the lifespan of this animal, and throughout the life of that animal, they have to be managed and handled in such a way to where they're still eligible for these programs. As we enter into this new market of low-carbon beef, which I am certainly excited about, both as somebody who's passionate as a steward of environmentalism or of our environment, but also as somebody who thinks that the beef industry holds the keys to some of the climate problems that we face in our world, it's even more so because at this point, it's not even just about the animal. It's about the grazing systems that the animal is in. It's about the cover cropping plans that are made oftentimes years in advance and the carbon sequestration that's involved. And so it takes so much management and thoughtfulness to get that product at some point in the future, that I have to know through an AMA that that market is going to be there today in order to make that investment. And so this bill is going to limit what I think many of us in this room is tremendous potential for the beef industry.
Kuntz on how the industry got here.
In my career, understanding the packing industry, there was really one question going forward. It was what company was going to have financial stress and what plants were going to close. This industry was at substantial excess capacity for almost my whole career, starting in the mid-80s up until things changed in 2016. 2017, you finally had more cattle than packing capacity. And that's been a recent phenomenon, and it's been exacerbated by COVID. But the industries have gotten out of balance in terms of supply and demand, and the resulting price difference we see is largely because of that.
He thinks those supply-demand numbers will come back into balance, thanks in part to the drought. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Climate Smart Ag and Forestry in itself is a mouthful.
John Duff is Executive Vice President, National Sorghum Producers on USDA's Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities.
It is. It's $1 billion. It's a huge pot of money. It's a huge effort. Of course, the grant program that you're referring to, $1 billion, saw extremely strong interest. We applied along with 450 other, along with 349 other groups, for a total of 450 programs that were proposed under this. And in a nutshell, what USDA is trying to do is figure out how. And help the market figure out how to function, the ecosystem services market, that is. There's a lot of opportunity, obviously, in sustainability and carbon and general ecosystem services for American agriculture. We are the leaders in agricultural sustainability, bar none. And we are largely not compensated for that, apart from the compensation that comes back for the commodity production itself. And so everyone's trying to figure out how to monetize that, how to get farmers compensated for that. But a lot of people are calling it the Wild West right now in terms of what these markets are paying for, how they're paying, what frameworks they're using, what methodologies, the value practices, how they're compensating the farmer, what the contract looks like, what the terms look like. All of those things are very, very up in the air and very unknown. And so what this program is trying to do is get to the bottom of all that. Say, here's what the practices should be. Here's what the value should be. Here's how the market should function. Here's how the contract should look. Here's what the terms should be. And help farmers really get better opportunities that are safer, less risky, that compensate them better and more fairly for the value of the ecosystem services markets that they're providing. And we submitted a program and project, like I said, just like 349 of the groups did. And it's, you know, it offers a menu of practices valued on how an ecosystem services market in California values them. Farmers will have the opportunity to pick and implement those practices in order to receive compensation.
Admits Climate Smart Ag has received criticism, but says at the end of the day,
it received a fair amount of criticism, even from folks in our industry on the front end, that, oh, this is $1 billion and it's a really quick turnaround. We ended up having about 90 days to submit a proposal, and it wasn't a very extensive proposal. It was an extensive effort, but the application itself was very long, and a lot of folks were understandably apprehensive about how a process like this could really translate into real answers. But, you know, after going through that process and thinking through all the things that we had to think through to put a program together, and to put a program together that over the next 5 years will lead to the outcome that we want, and that's clarity in ecosystem services markets for sorghum farmers, I think that it was a pretty good way to do it. It made us think pretty creatively about things. And I think with 450 different approaches, there's going to have to be some good ideas that come from all that. And will there be waste? Will there be inefficiencies? Absolutely, there always is. But frankly, that's part of the reason you want government to fund some of these things, is so that we've got the freedom to fail and realize that, hey, that was a bad idea. And so government kind of de-risks it, and hopefully 5 years from now and 450 shots at it, we will have a good idea of how to better compensate the farmer for the value of these practices.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
How is the nation's cotton crop holding up after another week of hideously hot weather in many growing areas?
Still not the greatest news to report there.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says cotton development nationally staying very close to last year's pace. As we start the week, we have 44% of the crop squaring, which is average for the state, 13% setting bolls. That's about 1% ahead of average, 3% ahead of a year ago. Now, cotton condition nationally.
Another slight decline this week, 36% of the crop rated good to excellent, down a point from last week, 31% very poor to poor. That is up a point from last week.
So the cotton crop in general looking far worse on average than last year at this time when we had 52% of the crop in good to excellent shape, only 10% rated poor to very poor. Of course, some terrible problems with the nation's top cotton state, Texas, where 48% of that crop's rated poor to very poor. Gary Crawford, Washington.